Thank you for tuning in to 2012 Journey to Evolution. This is Tambourine Borelli, and we are welcoming our fifth installment of this year's Prophets Conference. 2012 Tipping Point is the theme for this year's conference, and it's going to be held in Vancouver from July 23rd to the 25th is the main conference, and workshops going through the 27th. It's been so cool to interview some of the greatest minds in regard to this topic, and you're welcome to at any time download the archives from specific the Prophets Conference speakers, which include Miguel Angel, Jose Arguelles, Richard Tarnas, John Kimmy, and who am I forgetting? Let's see, John Perkins. Today we have John Major Jenkins, and I'm very excited to talk to him. You know, all of the speakers that I've interviewed in the past couple months, you know, although they're obviously they have their own perspectives, there's been a common thread with everyone, which I'm very excited about. And that common thread is that we have something to look forward to. Everyone shares in the perspective that it's not necessarily the doom and gloom that we've been made to think. There is a new era being birthed, and I'm very interested to hear what John has to say. Let me tell you a little bit about him. John Major Jenkins is a pioneer of the 2012 movement and a leading voice in the mysteries of ancient Mesoamerican cosmology. The author of 9 books on the subject, he has investigated the authentic sources of the 2012 tradition and has identified the astronomy, prophecy, and spiritual teachings connected to 2012. John, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to the show.
Well, Tamarina, I'm very glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
I should be welcoming you home, just period. You just got back home from Guatemala, huh?
Yeah, just got home from the Mission Izapa tour 2010, and we'll talk about that a little bit. It was very, very exciting and revelatory on many levels.
You know, I definitely have a few questions in regard to that. But generally, initially, I just wanted to ask you, you know, of all the perspectives that are out there right now in regard to 2012, as we get closer to 2012, the hype concerning the connection to the Mayan calendar, obviously, as you know, has been ever prevalent. I just want to ask you, in your perspective, where does your view differ from the majority mainstream and of your peers on the same subject?
Well, I think it's more in terms of the approach, and my approach differs in that I've wanted to delve into the Maya material. In other words, my work is about reconstructing what the ancient Maya actually thought and believed about 2012, and so I language it from that perspective. And in terms of, you know, the wide spectrum of different perspectives, we have on one extreme the doomsday perspective, which of course is generated by an exploitative media, and it's just completely erroneous because you don't have any evidence in the actual Maya information on 2012 that indicates an apocalyptic doomsday end of the world scenario. So anytime you see that little byline in some report or article or interview or anything, you know that it's just coming from this distorted, not just distorted, but just incorrect perspective on 2012. So some perspectives can be dispensed with. It's not an even playing field. You know, the menu of choices, one has to say that some of those choices are just going to be flat, not congruent or in agreement with what the ancient Maya themselves have said about 2012.
I think I heard just in this last year, for the first time, it was a Mayan elder representative that said, the article was saying for the first time they were speaking out saying, look, we never said, our people never said that the world was going to end. And I think that was the first time I ever heard the contrary in any kind of mainstream editorial or news information.
Yeah, that was the Associated Press interview that took place last year. And I talked to that reporter for a good 2 hours on the phone and encouraged him to not go down the same road that all the other reporters go down, which is, you know, to hammer the doomsday angle. And to you know, I gave him some names of some contact people he could talk to, and apparently he got through to that particular Maya representative. So that was definitely, you know, scoring a point for accuracy and clarity. Yeah.
It was totally groundbreaking. It definitely lifted some spirits of a lot of people, I'm sure.
Sure. But at the same time, you can also find modern, you know, speakers sometimes representing themselves as Maya people also hammering the doomsday angle because it sells. And it's one of those hot button things. And so you've got people have to exercise discernment, you know, just because a modern Maya representative says one thing doesn't mean it's the you know, graven truth. You know, in other words, modern Maya people might not be in agreement with what their ancient ancestors recorded in terms of what the original teachings and beliefs are around 2012, because you're going to get opinions no matter where you go with this.
Absolutely. And I think just based on what you just said, I think it's a prime opportunity to exercise a muscle that will be just a natural one in this new world, which is trusting your own knowingness, that voice inside that we've quieted for so long, to develop that muscle in, you know, not what this person says or that person says, but what do you say? What does your heart tell you? What does your intuition tell you?
Yeah, and investigating further, inquiring further, and not just accepting things at their face value, you know, looking more deeply into something. And that's the path of deepening consciousness, deepening gnosis, deepening truth on one's journey.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more on that one. I'd like to ask you if you could talk about the social structural differences in regard to what I heard you refer to as the denominator mode of culture and the partnership mode of culture.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That is a great topic. Yeah, yeah. This has to do with sort of the question of the Maya prophecy for 2012, if we can call it that. It's found in the Maya creation myth because the Maya creation myth talks about cycles, world ages, and we are approaching the end of a world age. And the mythological teaching stories in the creation myth are really revealing as to what the Maya expect to happen at the end of a cycle, at the end of any cycle, actually. It's more like an insight into the energy dynamics of cycles rather than some specific prophecy explicitly for 2012. It certainly isn't a literal prophecy in terms of an earthquake's going to happen on a certain date.
Right.
But yeah, to answer your question, this has to do with the dynamics between a limited ego consciousness, which is currently ruling and ruining the planet. And in the creation myth, this type of consciousness was represented by a deity named Seven Macaw. He's the false and vain ruler that appears at the end of the cycle and deceives humanity. And then the alternative to that is the consciousness of wholeness, of understanding one's root in the divine, eternal, infinite consciousness. In other words, it's the whole consciousness that makes decisions based on the good of the whole. And one way to understand this has to do with social structures, as you mentioned. And I draw from the work of Rhian Eisler on this. She talked about the dominator mode of society, which is kind of like the Seven Macaw self-serving egoism, which is certainly ruling the planet right now and causing all kinds of environmental degradation and devastation. And the dominator mode just seeks to dominate other cultures and usurp resources and so on and so on. The alternative is the partnership mode, which is more aligned with the whole consciousness that gets reborn at the end of the cycle. When seven macaw is put into proper relationship with the whole consciousness, this is like the hero twins putting seven macaw back into his proper place so that their father, one Hunapu, can be reborn. So it's just a simple dynamic between two extremes of consciousness, one of which is a limited consciousness that results in all kinds of problems for the world, and the other is a kind of whole consciousness that can lead through to a sustainable future through exercising partnership values.
Well, you know what I find really interesting in regard to that ideology is that what I hear you saying is transmutation almost in a way where it's the dark is transmuted and given a new life within a different construct.
I actually like that, yeah. That's definitely the way to think about it. It's not about killing the ego or dispensing with the ego consciousness. It's about transforming or transmuting that consciousness back into its right relationship, you know, placing it back into right relationship with the whole, and that's more of a transformative kind of process.
Yeah, I think that's powerful. I really find that useful. I like the way that you put that.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. And also another way I like to think about it is awakening. You know, we awaken to that whole consciousness. It's like we got cut off from that at some point. The human beings throughout some kind of large scale time process, you know, call it the fall of humanity or whatever you want to call it, but we sort of lost that connection to the transcendent, to the divine, to the wholeness. And that's, I think, what we're working towards restoring. And 2012 holds the promise of that through basically exercising this, you know, practicing the spiritual principles and spiritual teachings that you find in the Maya creation mythology.
Yeah, and you know, the more that I hear you talking in regard to that, and it's something that we touched on when we had a conversation earlier, was that that seems like to be the macrocosm of the microcosm in terms of our individual selves. Like, say, for instance, when we talked about the transmutation of the dark into the light. Now, say, just for the individual, what that looks like in terms of us getting complete with what still disturbs our peace, what we're still holding ourselves in judgment for our own darkness inside ourselves, that when we can take that and transmute it and become complete with it, then we take our place in the new era, in the new construct. So just, you know, as I was listening to you speak, I saw that on an individual level also. And as individuals, if collectively, when each individual becomes in alignment with themselves in that way, that how could it not become the collective macrocosm in terms of a complete shift in way of being?
Excellent, yeah. There's definitely an interplay between the collective and the individual. I tend to think that all change happens within first. It happens sort of on a grassroots level. It must be implemented or initiated by individuals, and then it sort of spreads like wildfire into the collective. I think that's really a good way to think about it. And as you mentioned, the web of illusions or the network of things that keep us stuck to you know, self-judgment or self-worth and all that kind of stuff that keeps our consciousness on a limited plane, well, that's really just a web of illusions. And it's keeping us from seeing the whole of which we are a part. And so the principle of sacrifice or surrender, I believe, and it's certainly present in the Maya creation myth as a spiritual teaching that's essential for transformation, it's really an important thing. Sacrifice is kind of a intense word for many people. You could think of it as surrender. But the important thing is that it's transformative in nature, and what needs to be surrendered is simply the illusions that keep us stuck. And so in retrospect, after we, you know, begin the work and we're doing the work, and many people recognize this on their spiritual paths, they look back and they see, wow, well, why was I even holding on to all that crap for so long? Right. I should have sacrificed that long ago, because now I'm in a much better place.
Right, and even worse, and I'll speak for myself, that, you know, I'd say about 5 years ago or so, I finally got the fact that I was always trying to do what was termed a spiritual bypass, meaning I repressed whatever darkness was inside me because I felt, oh, well, it's not spiritual to be angry, or it's not spiritual to be, you know, so whatever was true for me, or whatever judgments I was having of myself and the subsequent emotional chemicals that was cascading in my body, I would repress those. And as I'm sure you know, when you repress something, it doesn't go anywhere but deep inside you to be dealt with on another day.
Yeah, that's true. That's why another thing I like to advocate is just simple meditation. You know, it's one of the perennial spiritual practices that goes way, way, way back. There's evidence that the Maya had a kind of a yoga and meditation that they would do. You see meditating Maya on the carvings at times, but it's that breathing process, breathing in, breathing out, letting go, sitting with what is really there, not running away from it, and moving into it, and allowing it to be, and moving through it in a transformative process. That's really a good thing to recognize.
Yeah, there you go, moving through it, you know, sitting with what is, and looking at it, and then moving through it. You touched, that was a great, the moving through is what the powerful thing is, because you're not running away from it, you're not repressing it, you integrate it almost and take the pearl, take the wisdom, and from the chaos or from whatever you deemed as darkness or whatever, you take that like the oyster does with the irritation of the sand, and make that experience, which may have been uncomfortable initially, at the end result becomes a pearl of wisdom. So there definitely is some profundity to that analogy, for sure.
Yeah, and what I've tried to offer the discussion on 2012 is a kind of a Joseph Campbell-style interpretation of the archetypal level of the Maya creation myth. In terms of, you know, the teachings in there, the mythology, it's not just some quaint belief system of a forgotten people. I mean, there are these culturally specific deity names and phrases and stuff like that, but you have to look beyond the surface of appearances and identify the spiritual teachings that lie underneath, and then we find the great perennial wisdom teachings that are operative in all the world's great religious traditions. But there definitely are unique elements of the Maya cosmology as well, and this is kind of an exciting thing that's happening in terms of reconstructing a lost cosmology, you know, something that's real in terms of, what I've been engaged in for many years on one level is just a good old-fashioned nuts and bolts reconstruction of a lost cosmology that basically identifies why the Maya picked December 21st of 2012 to end this great cycle in their calendar. So beyond the spiritual teachings, we also have sort of the nuts and bolts astronomical science that identify, you know, kind of it means that the Maya were advanced 2,000 years ago in ways that scholars and scientists haven't been really willing to allow the Maya to be advanced. But
and what do you attribute that to, John?
The advanced knowledge that they have?
Yeah.
Well, I really think it's their innate brilliance. I mean, the long count and the 260-day calendar and other facets of the Maya tradition are not found elsewhere in the world, so it's not likely that they were handed to the primitive jungle savages by debarking Egyptians or something like that, or Atlanteans. I mean, I believe that there was a lot of, you know, traffic going on around the world. There was, I mean, the history of human civilization goes back further than we think, but what I've been able to find in looking at the origins of the long count calendar, the 2012 calendar, is that there was something very unique and brilliant that took place at a site called Izapa some 2,000 years ago, and that's where the long count was first inaugurated, and the creation mythology first appears on those monuments too. And so I think that it's just attributable to the innate brilliance of the Mesoamerican people. After all, these are the people that domesticated corn from a skinny wild grain over a period of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Going back, I think they've identified 8500 BC as the origin of the domestication of corn. So you've got millennia of advanced, brilliant intellectual thinking going on in Mesoamerica.
Well, let me ask you this. Obviously, you've spent quite a bit of time with the Mayan people, of which you have said there are 6 million full-blooded Mayan today on the planet, which perhaps I think you mentioned that there may not have even been that many back in the day when we speak of the ancient Maya. In your experience, in your observation, being with them, what would you say the difference is between these ancient Mayans who have made this calendar and this cosmology for us to study and the present day Mayan?
Well, there's huge differences. Of course, the modern Maya have been dealing with 500 years of, you know, conquest tactics. It's well known that the long count calendar that gives us the 2012 date fell into disuse hundreds of years before the conquest, actually. So this part of the calendar tradition has been lost. That's why it had to be reconstructed. But the 260-day calendar still survives alive and well in the highlands of Guatemala. I've been a great defender of this and advocate for following the accurate day count that survives in the highlands. The modern Maya also, probably most importantly, are still practicing the ceremonial rites that preserve the spiritual teachings or the spiritual understandings of what period endings are about. In other words, even though they lost the long count and they don't have any knowledge preserved, handed down to them from their ancestors about 2012 specifically, they still know very well what cycle endings and period endings are, and they still practice the essential spiritual teachings in their fire ceremonies. And it has to do with the same principles that you find in the Maya creation myth around the importance of sacrifice in order to successfully facilitate transformation and renewal. That's the formula: sacrifice, transformation, renewal. And it's still practiced, and you know, we were blessed to see and witness and participate in 5 traditional Maya fire ceremonies during this recent Mission Izapa 2010 tour that I just got back from in Guatemala.
Now, you mentioned that you had a little challenges when you tried to take the spiritual leaders of Guatemala across the border to Mexico. Tell me what happened.
Yeah, well, first of all, this idea was hatched about 3 years ago when my friend Mary Lou Rittinger and I were doing a radio interview in the town near Izapa. This was, you know, I've been there many times, and I've done tours there with my friend Jim Reed, and anyway, we realized that Izapa is in Mexico. It's close to the Guatemala border, but it is technically, it's in Mexico. It's 15 miles from the Guatemala border. And in Mexico, the INAH, the National Institute of Archaeology and History, doesn't allow religious ceremonies being performed in the archaeological sites. So it's unlike Guatemala. Guatemala actually allows that. And there's a lot of traditional Maya living in Guatemala. There aren't really very many traditional indigenous Maya people living in southern Chiapas, where Izapa is located. So Izapa, being the origin place of the calendar and the creation mythology, had been sort of cut off from access by the traditional Maya that are still living in Guatemala. So we had the idea to try to facilitate a minor miracle and get the traditional Maya over to Izapa so that they could perform ceremony and sort of symbolically or energetically reopen the site as a ceremonial spot, a sacred spot. Mm-hmm. And what I've said is that, you know, it's probably that there hasn't been ceremony performed at the site for some 500 years. So we were confronted with a bit of a problem getting visas for the Maya spiritual guides, of which we brought 12 or so in to Mexico. And then we also had a bit of a, you know, jumping through the hoops to actually be able to go into the site and have the ceremony performed. So, you know, it's been the work of many, many people. And thanks to Jim Reed and George Ann Johnson, who really got the ball rolling on this dream earlier this year in January. They really got the ball rolling, and now here we are, and we're all just overjoyed. You know, the 16 participants that came with us and the Maya spiritual guides, we're all still going back and forth on our various experiences during the trip, and it was very much a historical event for the Maya to be able to go into Azapa and perform ceremony.
Now tell me, if you can, just briefly, maybe one of the experiences that you encountered.
Well, it was very heart-opening, and the ceremonial process, as facilitated by Tat Rigoberto Itzep Chanchabak, he was our K'iche Maya liaison and spiritual guide that was really sort of leading the process. And each ceremony would take place at an altar set up in one of the sacred spots. We went first to a place called Iximche, and this was a town of the ancient Kakchikel Maya. And typically a ceremony would go over some 2-3 hours, you know, the process of setting it up and laying out the altar and laying around the flowers and the incense and the candles and the prayers that are said and the reading off of the day signs and burning the incense. And every time it was ended with some of the participants making their own offerings of candles and incense. And the offerings are like, you know, the sacrifice that's made. It's symbolic of the sacrifice that's made inside the heart to open up and, you know,
surrender.
Have a better connection, surrender and have a better connection with, you know, the reality. And there's a total human element to that. We would go around and then go around the circle and hug everybody.
Yeah.
A real important way to exercise communion rather than communication, because there's different languages being spoken. And if we stick to the word of communication, then there's always going to be sort of, disagreements, and you're not going to be clear. But if you transcend that and go to the level of communion, that's what's really important, and that's really what was achieved by the end of the week. We all sort of went away feeling like we had this shared bonding experience of communion in the sacred.
You know, John, and I've been saying just of late that I've really been impressed, like, impressed in the way it's been impressed upon me, how the moving of the consciousness into the heart is tantamount in regard to us as the human family moving and shifting into this next level of evolution. Being an initiator and a student of the mind in the past, and you know, an aspect of it I still am, but I've changed my perspective in terms of I won't even say I don't believe. I'll say I know that it doesn't have to do with the mind necessarily, that the key is bringing that down into the heart, because in the heart, in the language of love, is universal. It is the language of whatever you want to call it, God, source, prime creator, you know, and your experience that you just shared just confirms that for me. I think it's profound.
Yeah, it's totally right on and okay to say that you know it. It's not about belief or faith. It's knowledge, because there is a wisdom in the heart that provides direct access into the transcendent divine wisdom. This is recognized in the perennial philosophy and all the great metaphysical traditions of the Orient, for example, as the Bodhi mind, or the noetic consciousness, or the intellectus. You know, that's not to say that it's intellectual in terms of it residing in the brain or the mind. It's that higher faculty, that higher organ of direct perception of truth. And that's why it's gnosis. It's direct knowledge. It's not about frameworks of belief systems or having faith in something that's not seen. It's direct gnosis that comes from having glimpsed the higher truth. And that's kind of what this whole transformation is about, I think, 2012. You know, we're trying to establish or reestablish a connection with that wholeness, that higher dimensional wisdom or higher consciousness that should be informing all of our world's institutions.
Right.
You know, our institutions should be based upon the principles of an awareness of our connection to the whole or the higher wisdom, rather than being based upon the values of self-serving egoism. And so that's what the transformation's about.
You know, and think about it further in regard to what you called the partnership mode of culture. Now, let's just say, for instance, that in the next couple years, everything that we've known as structure of corporations, of, you know, business as usual, and the way that the world has interacted with nature, let's just say that all comes to an end, however means that it does come to an end. Now, let's say, what would be the end result of that? Well, I could see that there'd be a lot of partnerships out of just a new way of being that would have to be formed. Communities, you know, just reaching out and neighbor to neighbor and everyone helping each other, and there being some type of bartering system, because obviously there'd be no cash system or any kind of, you know, fiduciary means that there used to be in the past. So it would seem that if that were to be what is unfolding, perhaps it's not such a scary thing after all. Perhaps it's going to be the very thing that's going to connect us all back into our hearts and re-educate and remember, literally, remember how to be with ourselves and with each other.
That's it. You got it. Exactly. I totally agree. That's it. And it's not necessarily a scary thing unless you're clinging to the old ways of doing things, which is basically like clinging to illusion. And then, you know, what's going to be empowered is the creative. You know, creativity and forming new ways of doing things based upon sustainable partnership values. And, you know, transformative processes can be chaotic, but they can definitely reward, that's not the right word, they can definitely be times of opportunity for creating new ways of doing things. And I think that if we all have the good of the whole at heart, then this is going to be a great thing. You know, it's not something that's going to happen overnight, you know, in 2012, or, you know, we've got lots of difficult challenges on the political sphere, which kind of, in a sense, isn't really, you know, I'm not like a politician with this stuff. You know, I see these things happening. I'm more of a, I, you know, I can't wear all those hats. You know, I'm very interested in what I've called the Maya Renaissance. I wrote about this in my recent book, The 2012 Story.
That
the
was
going to
be one of my next questions.
Yeah.
About the Maya Renaissance. No?
It's related to what you were just saying, really. But we see a renaissance of indigenous leadership going on in Guatemala and other places. And I suggested in my book that we might be in the process of a larger scale renaissance of what you might call indigenous consciousness, which is meaning just to say that we all people on the earth could benefit from getting back in touch with their roots, with their source consciousness, you know, with their true humanness, you know, which then will connect us all into the whole. I talk about these things in terms of the perennial philosophy, which is a very, very profound framework of ideas for languaging these things. And so it has to do with a revival, as you said, you know, a revival of ways of doing things which are more fulfilling for human beings. You know, it's like we've been entrapped in these prisons that have been set up by the seven macaws, you know, the systems of self-serving egoism, which really aren't for the benefit of the whole, only for the few. And, you know, I look to the spiritual teachings in the My Creation Myth as insightful sources, you know, for what's going on. And I also recognize that the Maya were attuned into something very profound. I mean, I really don't know what's going to happen. We could speculate a lot on what's going to happen in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. On a kind of a more pedestrian level, I see, like, my work to reconstruct the lost cosmology, just the astronomy, and how that's built into the creation myth and the ball game and king-making rites, you know, this is all sort of a more or less academic reconstruction. But the work that I've been pursuing on that level has had to deal with a lot of ridiculous and underinformed, irrational critique by the scholars themselves. I mean, I'm basically an independent scholar working to offer something real in terms of reconstructing why the Maya picked this 2012 date. And so we can sort of, you know, pull it back a little bit and just talk about that. I mean, that's kind of one of the key things that I think gets overlooked sometimes, because 2012 does sort of connect into these more cosmic possibilities and so on.
Yeah, and because of that, I would say that independent researchers such as yourself, I personally tend to give a little more credence to, because, you know, I've found that most times they're the most, I'll just say, pure of intent.
Well, yeah, and it's also like, you know, a lot of breakthroughs in fields of study often do happen from the outsiders, because they're not imprisoned by the biases. So if any listeners are interested in that part of the work, I have set up a website called update2012.com, which has a lot of the play-by-play interactions and exchanges I've had with professional Maya scholars on this work. And it's pretty revealing of closed-mindedness and that kind of thing, but it needs to be done. And actually, there's a lot of breakthroughs happening now. And this is the stuff I love, really. I mean, I got into this, you know, 20 years ago when I, you know, first was, more than 25 years ago, 25 years ago when I was first planning my trip to Central America, and I got into this whole research, and now it's actually coming full circle, because we have new information from the inscriptions of a site called Tortuguero, which is affirming the ideas that I put on the table 15 years ago and published in my book Maya Cosmogenesis 2012. So it's been a long journey on that front, but I'd really count this recent tour to the ceremonial sites as really just almost like an incredible culmination of 25 years of research and work on the 2012 question. And I hope we can go forward into a place where the 2012 discussion can pay more attention to what the Maya are doing and what's up in the Maya world. I think we mentioned this briefly earlier, that there's a whole spectrum of different ideas and models and theories, and a lot of it isn't really plugged into even the basic facts on the Maya calendar. So there's a lot of problems in the marketplace with that kind of stuff, but again, people need to exercise their discernment and their consciousness as they explore 2012 more deeply.
Well, let me just ask you a question that had come up in my own mind when you were talking about the reconstruction of the calendar. How does one go about the arduous task of doing that, and how do you even know how to do that?
Well, it's about study and research and understanding how the Maya worldview works and familiarizing yourself with a wide spectrum of different information. There's a lot of information that comes through from ethnographers working with the Maya people that are alive today in the highlands of Guatemala. That's revealing of their general worldview. And then there's work done to reconstruct the ancient belief systems, you know, that you can get from the documents and the inscriptions, and how they understood the relationship between the sky and certain ceremonial acts and rituals and warfare even. And so it's really an interdisciplinary synthesis. And when it comes down to the details of the long count calendar, of course, one needs to understand how the long count works and how the 2012 date is calculated with the correlation. And, you know, it's really a process of asking the right questions. That's the way it's been for me. I mean, 20 years ago, I asked the question, where was the long count invented? And the great scholar Michael Coe said that the Azapa civilization clearly was involved in the formulation of the long count. So I went to the site of Azapa, and I found astronomical orientations there and the carved monuments, which they're sort of like pictographic statements, and so they are providing statements in terms of how they were thinking about the sky and time and the calendar and even spiritual teachings. So it's about...
Go ahead. You could finish.
Well, it's about learning the language that the Maya themselves were using to express their beliefs.
And within any of that, have you ever come across the perspective within the Mayan people that there are different versions of it that we can choose depending upon our consciousness? Like say, for instance, that there's two different worlds now existing, and as we get closer to 2012, depending upon where your consciousness is vibrating, that you will be either in the version that isn't very
desirable,
or the version that, you know, you're going to be a part of a new era. Like, you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Worlds will be created by consciousness. So those who choose to remain stuck in ego consciousness will continue to generate that world. And so the so-called prophecy for 2012, it's not about something that's specifically going to happen. It's more of a free will choice thing. You know, to say that something specific and definite is hardwired into the architecture of the universe and is going to happen to us in 2012 just means that we're unconscious robots or something. I don't think that's the way reality works. I mean, there are dimensions of choice that consciousness can make. Consciousness can choose to occupy different levels of reality, and some of those levels aren't that, some of those levels are pretty limited in what's possible for consciousness, and others are more free. So, this is something that I talk about a lot, actually, that there is a scenario of possibilities that human beings can choose, and, you know, there are probably as many different worlds as there are consciousnesses, you know, that's one of the funny things. And so, yeah,
now
we choose the level we want to be at. What's that?
I said, now you're talking my language.
Right. Yeah, we're on the same page with that. So yeah, it's about free will choice. And, but I think that there's also something going on, and I think this has to do with, where human beings are at. I mean, I think we're all kind of fed up with the way the world's been run by the seven macaws of the world. In my recent book, The 2012 Story, I actually go into the political sphere and point out how and why the seven macaw archetype is ruling our corporate structures and our political systems and so on. And I think that people are ready for a change, and it's got to happen, I think, first on a grassroots level. People have to stop feeding the seven macaw system and to start getting creative and creating new modes of being and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you to talk about the Maya Conservancy.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, the Maya Conservancy is a nonprofit that I was involved in founding and setting up. I guess the idea really was launched last year, but earlier this year it was officially begun in January. And the Maya Conservancy is dedicated to education, preservation projects, and facilitating events like the one that we just put on with the Maya Spiritual Guides. And the Maya Conservancy is going to be building a museum and visitor center right near the site of Azapa. And this is projected to be an educational resource that would go beyond 2012, of course, but it's my work that has pointed out the connection between Azapa and 2012. And so there's a great deal of excitement happening in the town of Tapachula near there, and Tuxtla Chico and southern Chiapas in general, and the Maya Conservancy has allies in the Tapachula area and that have been working towards this goal of helping people understand the profound thing that was happening there at Azapa some 2,000 years ago. And the Maya Conservancy is the major sort of channel through which there are going to be events like the Maya tour and other educational opportunities. So it's really a good thing. It's a nonprofit. The website is www.themayaconservancy.org, and we're going to have a lot of testimonials up there and pictures from the recent trip that have been sent in by the various participants. And also, Todd Rigoberto, the Maya Quiche Maya spiritual guide that was leading the group, gave a very moving speech when we were visiting with the mayor of Tapachula, and we are going to have that transcribed and translated as well. So a lot of good stuff going on.
Wow. That sounds, I just honor that. You know, I honor your passion and your work. It's just, it's very inspiring. I really appreciate you for just being who you are and the work that you're doing.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate you saying that. It's been my passion, and it's something that I basically started this whole thing on my first trip that I took when I was 22 years old, you know, having saved up some money working a job in the night shift, you know, for a year, and I went south of the border and I fell in love with Maya culture and Maya people, and I, you know, everything's sort of been an outgrowth of that. So I think that, you know, I've always been interested in drawing attention to the traditional Maya ways and teachings, and I think that's an important way to approach 2012 is through the authentic traditional teachings, which mainly, you know, include the surviving practices of the ceremonial process with the fire ceremony. You know, despite the fact that the long count 2012 calendar was lost to the Maya and the modern Maya don't remember it, you know, there is the spiritual teachings for period endings that are the essence of the tradition, and so that's an amazing thing.
Well, let me ask you, John, because I'm trying to grasp the difference between what you call the long count and then the 260-day calendar,
yeah,
the modern Maya. What is the difference?
Yeah. Well, the 260-day calendar is kind of the building block of all the calendars, but it runs alongside the long count. So in the dates, in the dated records, you'll find the long count calendar dating system, which is basically five place values counted from the zero date back in 3114 BC, and that leads up to the 2012 period ending in a great cycle of some 13 baktuns. That's the long count. And the 260-day calendar is probably older than the long count, and it consists of 13 numbers combined with 20-day signs, and the Maya still count the 260 days, and it kind of runs alongside the long count concurrently. But the long count part of the tradition was lost many centuries ago.
And that is what you're reconstructing, eh?
Yeah, well, the long count has been reconstructed by mainstream scholars. What the meaning of the 13 baktun cycle is in the long count, and what the meaning of the 2012 period ending of the 13 baktun cycle is, that's what my reconstruction has been concerned with. You know, why did they pick December 21st of 2012? That's been a great question, you know. the professional Maya scholars haven't approached that.
And you have.
Yeah, it was 20 years ago it occurred to me that, oh, well, the looks like the cycle ending falls on a solstice, December 21st, 2012. And so I asked the question, well, wouldn't that mean that it has some kind of intentionality built into it? What did the Maya think about 2012? And scholars at the time and up till about 2 years ago basically said, oh, solstice? Well, it just must be a coincidence. The Maya didn't have any particular thinking at all about 2012. So that's what my work has been up against for some 18 years. And yet, when I asked the question, I found really interesting information in the astronomy and in the traditions that, that's what my reconstruction's been about, reconstructing the astronomical basis of their 2012 cycle ending.
And so if someone were to ask you, in a sentence or two, what is your interpretation of the Mayan message, the Mayan calendar, as it is, as it pertains to this ever-hyped 2012, what would you say? What is your interpretation? What would you tell someone that's never heard anything about anything in regard to this subject?
Okay, well, I'd say that my interpretation is informed by, having studied the tradition, so I would hope that it's taken as a more or less accurate delivery of what the ancient Maya themselves thought about it. And I would say that the ancient Maya chose December 21st of 2012 because of a rare astronomical alignment that's happening, and going along with that are spiritual teachings, and those spiritual teachings have to do with cycle endings. And the Maya, the ancient Maya, believed that at cycle endings, the principle and value of sacrifice, sacrificing the illusions that keep consciousness stuck, is indispensable for facilitating a successful transformation and renewal. So there's sort of two parts to the equation. There's a profound astronomical science, and then there's also spiritual teachings that are embedded in the Maya creation mythology. The mythology and the astronomy go together, and they both point to or reveal how the Maya were thinking about this December 21st, 2012 date.
Beautiful. Speaking of cycle endings, we are approaching ours.
Okay, yeah.
I just wanted to take a minute and give an opportunity for you to share with anyone what you're up to, where they can get a hold of you, where they can grab your books, all of that good stuff.
Right. Well, sure, yeah. I've got a website for my recent book, The 2012 Story, and the website is www.the2012story.com. You can see events coming up on that page. One event's coming up, of course, is the Prophets Conference in Vancouver. I will be speaking on the Friday night, July 23rd. So if people want to see me there, try to get there for the July 23rd date in Vancouver. And 2 days before that, I'll be also giving a presentation at the East-West Bookstore in Seattle, Washington, July 21st. So those are the two things that are coming up immediately. And if you go to my website, you can also see a conference that I'm doing in Brazil in late July. And that would be something of great interest for some people that want to learn more about indigenous shamanism and those kinds of things. So that's what's coming up immediately. And people can certainly go to Google me, John Major Jenkins, and find my websites. Alignment2012.com has been the main one for about 15 years now.
Well, John, I look forward to meeting you. I intend on being at the conference in Vancouver, and I look forward to seeing you again, speaking with you again, and it's been a true honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much again.
I've really enjoyed speaking with you, and I look forward to meeting you in Vancouver.
Thanks, John. Everyone else, to remind you, every show we've been graciously giving from the Prophets Conference 2 tickets to attend that weekend. So feel free to email us. You can contact me through the show or directly at evolution at tambourineborelli.com, and we'd be happy to send you there so you can see John in person on that Friday night. Thank you for listening, and everyone have a safe and beautiful holiday weekend. Thanks again, John.
Okay, take care. Bye.
The beat.